Well, again, let me say that I appreciate very much the opportunity to be with you and the encouragement that you have been to me thus far in this meeting and during my days, from my hosts to those who have hosted me for lunch or for supper. Very, very encouraging. I'm not talking about the food. That's just a vehicle for the edification and strengthening and the encouragement that we can be to one another, and appreciate that so much. And this evening, I've got fleshly family here, a couple of family representations here, and that's always nice that, you know, your fleshly family knows you better than a lot of other people, and if they'll come and support you, that's a nice thing. And so I appreciate them being here, but we're all family, a spiritual family. And those bonds actually are supposed to be tighter than the fleshly families. And so let's remember that in our own relationships, your relationships with one another in this congregation, or if you're from a different congregation, remember that in your relationship there. Strengthen those bonds, because those are the eternal bonds. For decades now, there has been a great debate among citizens of the United States about immigration and creating a path to citizenship for those who came or were brought into our country illegally. And as usual, when it comes to things that turn political, there are simplistic talking point answers on all sides which do not adequately address legitimate concerns and complicated situations involving real people, just like you're a real person. Some of them good people, some of them bad people. The common ground that all sides have in the political debate is that all of us deem citizenship as very important. It's very important to us. And we know that from the passion that is expressed on the subject, no matter what side you take. Citizenship is important. We are affirming that. Additionally, though, add that into the combination of our own situations here in this country, we all have ancestors who at one time or another came here from another country, legally or illegally. And many of us probably don't have documentation to prove one way or the other. Maybe some of you do. Yet here we are, all of us, enjoying the rights of citizenship. Does that mean we should have porous borders or abandon the rule of law? Of course not. Certainly not. Does that mean we should do unto others as we want others to do to us? Yes, we should. That should be our attitude. I'm not requiring the government to have that attitude. That's the government's business. And the government is made up, though, of individuals. And you are an individual. And you are a part of these United States. And you are identifying yourself, most of you anyway, are identifying yourselves as Christians, followers of Jesus Christ. And Jesus instructed us that we should do and treat others as we would want to be treated. And we should apply that not to just this issue, but all issues. And sometimes we forget that foundational principle that Jesus gave us in his Sermon on the Mount. The word citizen comes from the word city and means simply an inhabitant of a city. But it is also used to refer to those who enjoy the rights and privileges of citizenship in countries, states, provinces, and such like. The dictionary definition of a citizen is a native or naturalized person who owes allegiance to a government and is entitled to reciprocal protection from it. Most of us have a natural affinity for and loyalty toward our native land. Likewise, the privileges that come with being a citizen are typically something that we appreciate and that we exercise, that we enjoy. And we often exercise those rights of citizenship to our advantage. And understandably, that's what they're there for. They're there for our advantage. And we should use them to our advantage. As Americans, we are familiar with the privilege of citizenship, and thus should, at minimum, understand, therefore, the desire of aliens to have a path to that citizenship. If it's something you enjoy, you should not be surprised that others want to enjoy it as well. And of course, as Christians, we have a different perspective on matters of citizenship, or at least we should have a different perspective on matters pertaining to citizenship. And I hope that this lesson will help to clarify that, help us to understand the value of citizenship. Now, you probably all can know when the New Testament scriptures were written. Under what dominion? It was the Roman Empire. In the days of Jesus and the early Christians, the Mediterranean region and beyond, off of this map as well, was dominated by one city. I circled it on the map. I don't know how well you can read that. It's Rome. However, not all who lived under its vast rule within its dominion had the status of Roman citizenship. There were many, indeed, who did not have that status of Roman citizenship. Citizenship was a privilege extended only to people born in the city of Rome and its colonies. And there's where our American history plays with us maybe just a little bit. Not thinking colonies like the British colonies so much. We're thinking of other cities that would be designated as colonies of the Roman Empire. But citizenship also could be purchased. Okay? Obtained and purchased, and thus probably wasn't especially accessible to the poor. Obviously, there were distinct advantages to citizenship, just like we know that there are advantages to being citizens of the United States. Paul was a Jew, ethnically, but he was also a Roman citizen, and he occasionally took advantage of his rights of citizenship. In fact, whenever we talk about our rights, we're oftentimes referring to a few texts where Paul exercises his to say, see, we are allowed to exercise our rights as citizens. Just like we talked with Liberties the other night, though, I would encourage you to look at the context in which he did that and see how he used those rights, that right of citizenship. And so let's do that with one of these. Let's go to Philippi. That's the other circle I put up there that is east of Rome. And so we'll turn to Acts chapter 16. Acts chapter 16, and many of you who know the book of Acts fairly well probably can tell me what this chapter is about. We're going to talk about the city of Philippi, and Philippi was one of those Roman colonies in the region of Macedonia, which was today northern Greece. And so it was here that Paul and Silas healed a demon-possessed slave girl who until they healed her, had brought her masters much profit by fortune-telling. I don't know how all that worked. We're not given the details of that. I could imagine some ways that it would. But needless to say, her healing, which was to her benefit, was not to the benefit of her masters. And they're peeved. They are not happy about that. You see that there in verses 16 through 19. And notice the charges then in verse 20 that are made against Paul and Silas. These men who had lost their means of income brought Paul and Silas to the magistrates and said, "These men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city. And they teach customs which are not lawful for us, being Romans, to receive or observe." Okay, so notice there. They identified them as Jews. And they identified themselves as Romans. There's a big distinction there. They're making a claim to citizenship and saying these non-citizens, Jews, were causing trouble here. They accused them of teaching customs that it was not lawful for Romans to engage in. And this got Paul and Silas publicly beaten and imprisoned as common criminals. And they're in a Roman colony being charged by Roman citizens as Jews, as troublemakers. And this probably wasn't all that uncommon in the Roman Empire for those who had citizenship to flex their muscles when they didn't like what non-citizens were doing. But notice what happened the next day. This is, and I'm skipping our favorite part where there's the conversion of the Philippian jailer. I'm trusting you know that story fairly well. If you just keep reading where we had just left off, you'd finish that story. If you don't know that story, I encourage you to read it while you catch up with me later. But where I'm going to go to verse 35. This is the next day. After the Philippian jailer, who held Paul and Silas in prison, had been baptized, and his household had been baptized. It says, when it was day, the magistrates sent the officers saying, "Let those men go." So the keeper of the prison reported these words to Paul, saying, "The magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace." But Paul said to them, "They have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans, and have thrown us into prison, and now do they put us out secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and get us out." And the officers told these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. Then they came and pleaded with them and brought them out and asked them to depart from the city. So they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia. And when they had seen the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. Now, it's kind of a mystery. We're not told what prompted the city officials to order their release. Perhaps, and again, this is just me thinking off the top of my head, the earthquake was viewed as some sort of sign to the magistrates that had taken place, or perhaps the story of the prisoners not fleeing when all of the cell doors were opened caused them to wonder. Or maybe the Philippian jailer had sent to the magistrates and told them more details about these men and about Paul and Silas's exemplary behavior. I don't know. We're just told they had a change of mind overnight and they say to let them go. But Paul uses the occasion to challenge the legality of their actions on the basis of their Roman citizenship. Now think about this. Paul and Silas had been publicly beaten and humiliated already. And Paul likely felt it right for them, therefore, as the magistrates who had ordered that done, to publicly acknowledge their injustice, as we talked about last night. And if they had just done what the officers had told them to do, just go ahead and leave town peaceably, now you're free to go. If they'd listened to that request to quietly leave town, they would have done so under a cloud of suspicion, because after all, they had been publicly beaten. So everybody in town knew that they had been beaten, what they'd been beaten for, what they had been accused of, that they had been thrown in prison. And so this would just look like guilty men who escaped as a result of the earthquake. And challenge for them to say, no, they can come and do this themselves, to challenge the legality of what was done to them, would exonerate not only them, but the gospel that they were preaching, and might possibly serve as a protection for the new Christians in that community, Lydia and her household, Philippian jailer and his household, and others, so that they might be left alone as well. Again, I'm reading between the lines. I'm only offering to you some possibilities that would make sense here. Maybe you have got some ideas, and I would be happy to hear them. But what is really curious is why, as Roman citizens, they waited until this moment to identify themselves as Roman citizens. When would you have identified yourself as a Roman citizen? I'll tell you when I would have. As they were grabbing me and taking me to the stocks to flog me, I just said, whoa, due process here, I'm a Roman citizen. And we wouldn't fault them for that at all. But they didn't do that. They didn't do that. Again, we're not told why they didn't do that, but we are told that they exercised their right, identifying themselves as Roman citizens after they suffered. Why? And various guesses might be made, and we wouldn't know how to verify any of them. But regardless, their imprisonment actually proved to be an opportunity for the spread of the gospel in converting the jailer and his household. And who knows what impact it had on the other prisoners who had open cell doors, they fly open and they stay put. They had heard them praying. They had heard them singing. We know that because the jailer, we were told that about the jailer. And the jailer is the one who comes running into them saying, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" These men, while in prison, were preaching the gospel through their songs and their prayers. And people were listening that you wouldn't think would listen or would care. Brethren, what does that say about us? That when we are in the public forum, that we are in whatever places we find ourselves, it doesn't have to be in the straits of a prison, but even in those contexts, pray, sing, let it be known. Not to be seen of men like the Pharisees did. Were Paul and Silas doing this to be seen of men? No, but they were seen of men. And it had an impact on the spread of the gospel in the Roman colony of Philippi. Something that wouldn't have happened if they had exercised their rights as Romans, at least not the way that it turned out in this particular story. And again, I'm not suggesting that Paul was thinking, let's just hold back on the Roman citizenship here because we might have an opportunity to do a prison ministry. I don't know that that was in his mind at all, but that's the way it worked out. Isn't that fantastic? That sometimes the awful circumstances in which we might find ourselves, for which we would be praying as they were, to get out of those circumstances, are circumstances in which it is going to be an opportunity for the gospel to be spread, or at least seeds to be sown. Let's try to look at our trials in that way. They became great examples of endurance of injustice. They were examples of endurance of injustice while doing good in preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. Remember, that's what we have been called to. That's our calling, brethren, to do good and suffer for it. And that's what they did. And in so doing, Peter tells us that they were being like Jesus Christ, with whom they identified themselves. And so the next time you're about to suffer for something that is an injustice, that isn't fair, keep Jesus in mind. Keep Paul and Silas in mind. And I'm not saying don't exercise whatever rights you have. I'm just saying that if it doesn't work, or if you don't have that opportunity, or whatever circumstances take place, it's not over. Yes, you can cry unfair, unjust. It's not fair, like we said last night. But look for the opportunities even in those circumstances. Of course, later we know that Paul continues to be persecuted. Let's go to another situation that we're familiar with in Acts chapter 21. Yeah, so turn with me over to Acts chapter 21. And this is in Jerusalem when Paul had returned back there, and he'd been warned multiple times by the Holy Spirit that if he went to Jerusalem, he would be bound there. He would be arrested. But he still went. So even God's telling him, if you go there, you're going to be arrested. But he still goes. In chapter 21, and I'll begin reading at verse 27. This is when they decide to go into the temple. They've been given advice by the elders of the church in Jerusalem to go with these men, just to dispel the rumors that were being said about Paul that were not true. And they were doing this vow. They were engaged in this vow. It says, when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on Paul, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people the law in this place. And furthermore, he has also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. And all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together, seized Paul, and dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. Now, as they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison that all of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains. And he asked who he was and what he had done. And some among the multitude cried out one thing, some another. And when he could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken into the barracks. And when he reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying out, "Away with him!" And as Paul was about to be led into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I speak to you?" The commander replied, "Can you speak Greek? Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago raised an insurrection and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?" And Paul said, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to the people." So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hand to the people, and when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew language. Let's stop there for a moment. Paul, in this instance, does not directly use his Roman citizenship here. He does identify himself as a citizen. He identifies himself, though, as a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, and thus a citizen of that above-average city, this unique city. Why this carried weight with the Roman soldier is not revealed in the scriptures, but Tarsus was known to be historically a center of learning that rivaled Athens and Alexandria. Okay? You may never have heard of Tarsus outside of the Bible. You've heard of Athens. You've heard of Alexandria outside of the Bible. Tarsus was right up there with them. So this was not just an ordinary, common first century city that he was from, and he knew that they knew that. And it may simply be that Paul's obvious education, he could speak Greek, he was surprised at that, and Hebrew, obviously, made it clear he was not the guy that he thought he was. So, these connections enabled Paul to have an opportunity to address the mob under Roman protection. And that's what chapter 22 is all about. And we're not going to take the time to read Paul's sermon, but I recommend it if you've not read it before. You just keep start reading right there at verse 1 and keep going. Many of you will have been familiar with it. What I want to call attention to is the point at which in Paul's sermon that the crowd quit listening to him. He talks about having witnessed the risen Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. And they remain quiet. And they keep listening. He tells them about Ananias coming to him and teaching him the gospel and calling, challenging him to be baptized, calling on the name of the Lord. And they remain silent. And they keep listening to him. It wasn't when he told them that Jesus warned him that the Jews in Jerusalem would not receive his testimony, that he had been, that God had actually been told him that they won't listen to you. They keep listening, which is kind of almost an oxymoron. They are listening to him. They keep listening to him. They don't say, "Oh, we're not going to listen to you anymore." But when he quoted Jesus, when Paul quoted Jesus as telling him that he would send him to the Gentiles. Chapter 22, verse 22. They listened to him until this word. And then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live." It's always interested me. They patiently, I don't know how patient they were, but they were listening to him. They give him opportunity to speak, to present his case, talking about the resurrection of the dead of Jesus of Nazareth. But when he says that Jesus told him to go to the Gentiles, they go berserk. There was no controversy that they got all upset about when he taught that Ananias taught him that he needed to be baptized. We try to teach that amongst those who call themselves Christians and they go berserk. They listen to that. But when he says that Jesus said, "Go to the Gentiles with this," that is intolerable. After Paul's speech to the Jewish mob, verse 23, then as they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust in the air, I told you they went berserk, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that he might know why they shouted against him. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is Roman and uncondemned?" When the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, "Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman." And the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" He said, "Yes." And the commander answered, "With a large sum I obtained this citizenship." And Paul said, "But I was born a citizen." Immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. And the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because he had bound him. So not only was Paul born in Tarsus, he was also born a Roman citizen. And you might think, well, that probably means Tarsus was one of those Roman colonies. It wasn't. At least historically, we don't know that it was. It was a free city, but it was not a Roman colony, and thus being born there did not necessarily confer Roman citizenship status. And thus, one of Paul's ancestors must have somehow obtained Roman citizenship, which would then confer that by birth unto his descendants. Again, what I'm trying to emphasize here is that the status of being a citizen prevented Paul from being examined, which basically meant tortured and interrogated without due process. Because a citizen was entitled to due process. And so significant was this that those who had been involved into his involved with his mistreatment to this point withdrew. We're not touching this guy because he is a Roman citizen. Indeed, while this status did not get Paul released, it did get him protection that he would not have otherwise had. Ultimately, as we know, as you complete the book of Acts, it enabled him to appeal his case to Caesar. So go with me over to chapter 25 now. Acts chapter 25, and beginning with verse 10. So then Paul said, and this is after a couple of years, actually, of being in prison, under protective custody, we might want to say it that way. Paul is standing before Festus. He says, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know, for if I am an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar. Festus, when he conferred with the council, answered, you have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go. Your average Jew could not appeal to Caesar and go anywhere. Paul could only appeal to Caesar as he did because he was a Roman citizen. And so Paul used his Roman citizenship. It is true. But I get no impression whatsoever that Paul was proud of his Roman citizenship. We know what Paul was proud of. We know what Paul boasted in. Paul boasted in Jesus Christ. He merely used his Roman citizenship to accomplish good for his king. And I want to suggest to us that that is how we ought to use any earthly citizenship rights that we enjoy. So let's make application to ourselves on our present path to citizenship. In relationship to this world, go with me to Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews chapter 11, and beginning with verse 8, these will be familiar verses to you. We're familiar with chapter 11 and the many people of faith that are highlighted there by name. It says there in verse 8, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would afterward receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Let me just skip ahead there just a little bit. Let's go over there then to verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. He's talking about the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You know the story. Abraham was called to leave the land of his nativity, and by faith, he obeyed. Remember what it said here in this reading in Hebrews. He went out not knowing where he was going. All of you have been very kind when I've come to your home to make sure I knew where I was going. And now with these little devices, I can just say, no problem, I have your address, I know where I'm going. We like knowing where we are going. In fact, if my phone were to fail me, all of a sudden I would panic. Like, I don't know where I'm going. Abraham did not know where he was going, but he went by faith, because God told him to. Faith, by the way, we learn, does not require knowing and understanding everything. And sometimes that's, I think, the way we act. I've got to understand this before I can believe it. That's nonsense. You don't believe that, actually. You probably drive over bridges occasionally, but you don't know that that bridge is going to hold you. Sorry if you've got bridges to go home by out tonight and now you're a little worried. You plug your devices into the wall, and unless you're an electrician, you have no idea how that's working. I use this crazy device right here, sort of, well, and I have no idea how it works. None. I do not understand. And some of you do, and you try to explain it to me, and my eyes glaze over. I don't understand. There's all kinds of things that we don't completely understand that we still use. And some of it we do by faith, by trust, by confidence in other people. God has asked us to act in faith, in Him, trusting Him. Look, but if I don't understand it, I can't believe it. False. That is not true. Quit telling yourself that lie. Abraham went out not knowing where he was going. And we're told that he sojourned as in a foreign country. He lived in tents. He was homeless. Faith makes us different than those among whom we live. And we live among them maybe as unsettled people. We're not citizens of, we're not from around there. We don't have roots there. It's faith that makes us able to do that. That's what Abraham illustrates for us. We're told what he was looking for. He waited for the city which has foundations, not a tent, on some piece of land, whose builder and maker is God. Faith keeps us from settling for less than what God has promised. And brethren, that's one of my greatest fears for those of us who live in relative affluence, is that we put our faith and our trust in something else other than God. And we've settled for something less than what God has promised. Abraham's sojourn is a type of our present sojourn, and we need to look at it that way. That's why his story is told over and over and over again in the Scriptures. It is exemplary because the faith of the patriarchs did not waver, even with the prospect of death. Notice that there in verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises. The people who are still alive when they die would go, yeah, there go those nutcases. They came from we don't know where. They pitched their tents. They wandered around here. And they died and never got their promises. That's the way it would appear from the earthbound perspective. But God tells us they did obtain it. Because earthly citizenship was not of importance to Abraham because of the promise of God. And he believed the promise of God. And God counted that faith as righteousness. Was Abraham a perfect man? No, we know he wasn't a perfect man. But he believed God. And he was content to be a foreigner for the rest of his life. Brethren, my question for us tonight is, does that describe us? Would we be content to be a foreigner for the rest of our lives? And I want that to give us just a different perspective of the people who are fleeing their poverty in another country to try to come to this one. They're content to come here and be foreigners for the rest of their lives and be generally looked down upon because of the way that they came here. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating for illegal aliens. I'm advocating for human beings. Because even if they're illegal aliens, they're still souls created in the image of God. And how did we learn last night that the God of justice wants us to treat the stranger, the foreigner? I know that steps on our toes. But we've got to not get wrapped up in the debates of the world about these things. We need to get wrapped up in the word and will of God and the character and justice of God. And that's going to change the way that we interact with the people of the world, and they're not going to like us for it because we're foreigners. And our allegiance that we pledge is not to the flag of this country primarily, but to God and His ways and His rules, His will and His characteristics are what of most importance to us. And we despise anything else. If you're only here for this first night, I'm using some language that I borrowed from my other sermons, and you may be misunderstanding me, and if you have any concern about what I'm saying, please talk to me afterwards. Our faith in God is supposed to have us desiring a better country. Not a better America, a better country altogether that we call home. This world is not my home. We sing that song. Do we mean it? Do we act like it? 1 Peter chapter 2. And if you know 1 Peter, you had to know that I was going to go there eventually. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11. Peter is writing to Christians. He's writing to saints. In fact, if you go back to chapter 1 and verse 1, you notice who he addresses it to. My translation says, to the pilgrims of the dispersion. And he names some of the Roman provinces. To the pilgrims. Maybe yours says something like sojourners or foreigners, something like exiles. That's really the idea of the word, by the way, exile. To the exiles. He's writing to Christians and he calls them exiles. What do you think of when you think biblically about exiles? You think about the Babylonian captivity, maybe. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These were exiles away from the promised land, living in Babylon. He's writing to Christians who are living in the time of the Roman Empire, and he's calling them exiles. Now, chapter 2, verse 11. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims. Okay, since you are exiles, this world is not your home. Abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. So our status in relation to this world, how we're supposed to see ourselves relative to the land that we live in, is that we're sojourners, we're foreigners, we're aliens, we're exiles, we're immigrants. That's how we're supposed to look at ourselves. That's what Peter says. And that status should then have us abstaining from fleshly lusts and to have our conduct honorable, just like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego in Daniel chapter 1. We are not seeking the acceptance or even the citizenship of this world. That's not what we're ultimately seeking. We are seeking that city, to be a citizen of that city that Abraham was looking for, that heavenly city. So let's talk about citizenship just a little bit more and we'll wrap this up. Ephesians chapter 2. In Ephesians chapter 2, I'll begin reading at verse 11. It says, "Therefore remember that you, once Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision," in other words, Gentiles were called that by the Jews, "made in the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world." Paul is writing to Gentiles, reminding them, Gentile Christians, reminding them about what their status before God was before they came to Jesus Christ. Aliens, he says, to the commonwealth of Israel. That word commonwealth, maybe you got a different word there than commonwealth there. It's the same word that is translated citizenship in Acts 22 and verse 28 that Claudius Lysias, the guy who arrested Paul, said he had purchased. You were aliens to citizenship, basically. You were foreigners. Strangers from the covenants of promise. You didn't have the rights of a citizen, is what he's reminding them. Having no hope and without God in the world. It was a hopeless situation. He is reminding them of that. And that's the way it is. It's a hopeless situation for mankind without Jesus Christ. But now, he says, in Christ, it's a complete reversal. You are no longer aliens, strangers, or hopeless. It's a path to citizenship in the eternal city. And by eternal city, I do not mean Rome. I mean the heavenly city. Chapter 2 and verse 19. It says there, "Now therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household or family of God." So you've got citizenship being used as an illustration. You've got family adoption aspects being used to try and convey the idea of what we obtain when we are saved by Jesus Christ, when we live as saints. We are fellow citizens, he says, with the saints, the holy ones. He's speaking of those who've gone on before, faithful, like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now we are members of the household of God. Jesus is the path to citizenship in the dominion of God, the kingdom of God. Go with me to Philippians chapter 3 and verse 17. Ah, Philippians, we started making reference to Philippi. Remember Acts 16? It's a Roman colony. Having that in mind as you read the book of Philippians can be a little bit helpful. In Philippians chapter 3 and verse 17, it says, "Brethren, join in following my example and note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern. For many walk, of whom I have told you often and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body that it may be conformed to His glorious body, according to the working by which He is able even to subdue all things to Himself." We are invited by the Apostle Paul to follow the apostolic example and the early Christians who so walked and used them as our guide, our pattern, our model for how we ought to live and how we ought to prioritize our lives. And we are warned that there are many who are walking as enemies of Christ, who are setting their minds not on heavenly things, but on earthly things, earthly loyalties, earthly ways, earthly values, earthly politics. And what is their end? Destruction. In contrast, what we're supposed to do, where we are to set our minds, our citizenship is in heaven. So we're not waiting on Washington, D.C. That's not our hope. Our hope isn't found in getting the right number of representatives in the House, maintaining control of the Senate, or getting the right justices appointed to the Supreme Court. Those are all temporal things. And boy, as Americans, we ought to know that. The founders of our country intentionally set up our country to be overturned every 4 years. This is not a stable environment. It's changing all the time. Don't put your trust in our government. And brethren, if you want to look on a more global scale, we're not looking for global change. We are looking for a transformation that is out of this world. And so let us ask ourselves, are we more concerned with the preservation of the American nation and way, or the coming of the kingdom of heaven and His will be done? And in which of those does loyal citizenship matter most to you? What is the path to citizenship about which you are the most concerned and want to do something about and have the strongest opinions? Jesus assured His disciples that He was going to prepare a place to come again and receive them to Himself, that wherever He was, they may be also. And He gives us the path of citizenship right there in that context, in John chapter 14. What is the way? What is the way? Jesus' answer was, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus is the path to citizenship in the eternal kingdom of God, and it's the only kingdom that matters because it's the only kingdom that will endure. And that path passes directly through the cross of Jesus Christ. The way of the cross leads home. Are you in that way? Are you a citizen of the kingdom? If not, you need to come to Jesus. You need to submit to Jesus as King. Be a part of His kingdom. And if we can help you to that end, let us know all together. We stand and sing.